Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up on today's program, hear the cry of the oppressed. Two English bishops return from a visit to Zimbabwe and South Africa. Greek Catholic Church leaders from Ukraine make their first ad limina visit to the Vatican in over 70 years. The outgoing director of the Anglican Centre looks back at the problems and the progress made during his time in Rome. But first, Cardinal Walter Kasper explains the changes Pope Benedict has made to the prayer for Jews in the traditional Good Friday liturgy. Vatican newspaper L'Osservatore Romano this week published the new text of a prayer in Latin used by followers of the Tridentine Mass for Good Friday liturgies. The move follows concern expressed by Jewish communities worldwide that the traditional prayer in use before the Second Vatican Council contains offensive language that does not reflect progress made since then in Christian-Jewish relations. Last summer, Pope Benedict issued a motu proprio allowing traditionalists to use the old-style Tridentine Mass. As Cardinal Walter Kasper, head of the Vatican's Office for Relations with Jews, explains, the change to the language of the Good Friday prayer is to ensure a continuing dialogue in a climate of mutual respect.
We have a very complicated and difficult history between Jews and Christians, and therefore the Holy Father wanted to take in account the sensibilities which exist, and he has cancelled one formulation in the prayer of the extraordinary liturgy for Holy Friday, where it was said about the blindness of the Jews. This was cancelled, but on the other hand, the Holy Father could not cancel what is essential for our Christian faith, that Jesus is the Christ. It means he is a Messiah, he is a Son of God, and he is a Redeemer of all people, also of the Jews. That's our Christian faith. And this is not an obstacle for further dialogue with the Jews. We want this dialogue, we need this dialogue, because we have so much in common. But there is one fundamental difference also between Jews and Christians, the difference in Christology, in the faith in Jesus Christ. And dialogue means to recognize the identity of the other. We Christians have to respect the identity of Jews, and they also have to respect our Christian identity. And only on this basis a dialogue is possible. It's also a question of religious freedom. Jews cannot prevent us to give testimony of our faith, as we cannot prevent them to give testimony of their own faith. Instead of the language of contempt, which was prevailed in the past, as Julie Sack told us, today we have to respect each other in our respective difference. And with this difference we have to live, but this does not impede us to collaborate for justice and peace in the world and to give common witness of the many things we have in common.
Cardinal Walter Kasper heads the Pontifical Council for Promoting Christian Unity and the Vatican Office for Relations with Jews. Hear the cry of the oppressed. That's the urgent message that two English church leaders have brought back at the end of a 10-day visit to Zimbabwe and South Africa. Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor, head of the Bishops' Conference in England and Wales, and Bishop Crispian Hollis, chairman of the International Affairs Department, met with church leaders in the two Southern African nations and visited church-run projects supported by Catholics in the UK. During their short stay in Zimbabwe, Bishop Christian told me he was shocked and moved to see just how desperate life has become for the vast majority of people in a country where the economy, the health and education systems and all vital infrastructures have collapsed. Nowhere, he said, is that more visible than in the sprawling township of Mbare, not far from the capital, Harare.
It was a town which I visited a couple of years ago when I went to Zimbabwe, and where I and another bishop celebrated Mass for the community in that parish at that time. It was devastating to see it then, because it was a parish which had been virtually bulldozed of all its infrastructures and its shanty towns and its street traders and so forth in the great clearance operation that the Mugabe government had operated the previous summer. So to go back to that place again was to revisit something which had been most striking 2 years ago. And I have to say that when we visited this time, things are worse than they were 2 years ago. There is extreme poverty in that parish. There is a great incidence of disease and HIV/AIDS. And there is sheer hunger as well. And we spent a good deal of time, not so much with the people, but with the parish priest, who's the former Jesuit provincial in Zimbabwe, a German priest, and just listened to him. And when we came away from listening to him and the way in which he cared for his people and the conditions under which he was working, frankly, we were kind of speechless. We didn't know what to say, really, to one another. And as we drove away in the car, there was a kind of silence in the car, because it had been most moving in a way, been most terrible in another way, but to see, you know, that pastor working with such faith and dedication and love for his people in impossible conditions was something which was the church at its very finest, I think. We then went on to a hospice for children who are infected with HIV/AIDS. And there are, of course, orphans. The number of orphans in Zimbabwe, indeed in southern Africa, is a very high number, because parents die and the children are left, but they also often carry the infection. So this was a hospice run by the Little Company of Mary, they call them the Blue Nuns. And Sister Margaret, who was in charge of that, has a number of children actually in care, in bed care in the hospice, but she also operates a team of 70 or so people who work out in the townships and in the so-called homes of the people who are orphans and who are infected. And it's just, again, a remarkable work of caring for the sick and the poor and the diseased. And again, something which, again, leaves one kind of speechless with admiration and amazement at such faith in such adverse circumstances.
It's true to say, isn't it, that there are a growing numbers of desperately poor and sick people almost entirely dependent on handouts from the churches for their survival?
I think that's true. And certainly in terms of, I mean, if you look at Zimbabwe today, the bishops told us that the health service has collapsed, in a sense, and it's very difficult for, unless you've got money, to get any medical assistance. Things like antiretroviral drugs are distributed by this particular clinic that we visited, this particular hospice that we visited, but it's very difficult to get hold of them in other ways. I think so. The issue of those drugs, which are crucial in combating HIV/AIDS, provided the other conditions of life are properly there, that's almost something which is out of the reach of ordinary people.
This situation has been going on for so long now. People must have almost given up hope of change, haven't they?
You'd have thought so, but in a curious way, there's an extraordinary faith among the people there. And this, again, was moving. 2 years ago, the Mass we celebrated in that township, which was pretty devastated then, was again something which I shall never forget, because it was a Mass of celebration in most appalling circumstances. And there was a faith there which was palpable in a way, and in a curious way, a joy that was palpable as well. The Archbishop told us that church attendances on the whole are rising in Zimbabwe. Now, that's partly to do with the fact that the church is a source of help and charity as well, but it's also it's a place where celebration can take place in the most awful circumstances, and I think that again is a very strong witness to the life of the gospel, which the church is proclaiming in so many different ways, most particularly in the most practical ways of care and compassion for the sick and for the poor.
Bishops there in Zimbabwe have issued a very strong pastoral letter about a year ago calling on the government to hear the cry of the oppressed people in their country. Is there anything else they can do, do you think, to try and push for change? Is there anything more that the church should be doing there?
I think the church has been remarkable in the witness that it's given, and that pastoral letter issued last Easter was indeed a very powerful letter, bravely written in a very complex scenario, I think, and therefore it was a letter which engendered a certain amount of opposition and division, even within the community of the faithful, because there are those, obviously, in a situation such as Zimbabwe is, who will be more supportive of the government than others, and they may be Catholics as well. And so the bishops risked a certain amount of conflict, certainly with the government as well as among their own people. But basically what they're now looking for, because there are discussions and debates going on about a new constitution and there are elections coming up, what is desperately needed and what the bishops are calling for as loudly and as bravely as they can is a new constitution, a constitution which will incorporate justice with good government and which also will respect the basic rights of the people, especially the poor, who are the vast majority, of course. That's a campaign which is ongoing, and they have their voice in that, and they have their voice with other Christian leaders in that as well, in that process, which hopefully will lead eventually to a new constitution, though sadly it seems not before the elections take place on March 29th.
The former finance minister has said he will challenge Mugabe in these presidential elections. Does that represent a glimmer of hope, do you think?
I think it must do, because 2 years ago we asked the question of the bishops, what happens when the president goes? What happens when Mugabe goes? And their view then was that the official opposition was not really in a position to make a serious challenge to the presidency or for the presidency. And they said then that they thought that whatever happened after the president gone, or President Mugabe had gone, would come from within the ruling party, and that seems to be the way that is happening.
You were clearly very moved by these experiences, and yet, as you say, it's a very complex situation. How do you begin to communicate this to people back in the UK, back in your own diocese, to try and encourage them to support the oppressed people in Zimbabwe?
I mean, all I can do is to tell my story in a way, and that I should be doing around the diocese during Lent. It's kind of not a bad Lenten exercise in a way. If we're on about prayer, fasting, and almsgiving, then let's put that in the hands of the people of Zimbabwe, really, and put it in the Lord's hands for them. But I will tell the story. That's what I can do. And I'd be often quite diffident about voicing my, strictly speaking, political opinions, because I'm no expert in that field, but I know what I've seen, and I know that for sure what I've seen has, in a very large measure, to be laid at the feet of the present government in Zimbabwe. There's no question about that.
What do the church leaders in Zimbabwe expect from Christians in the West? What else can we do to help?
But that's a good question, and it's one we asked the Archbishop as well. Of course, the obvious things, in a sense, are prayer and the sense of community and communion within the church worldwide. I mean, that in a sense goes without saying. On the more political level, the bishops are kind of saying that the whole policy, particularly from the EU, of sanctions on the government, targeted sanctions on 200 people in the Zimbabwe government, is actually not helpful, because the government simply has easy ways of avoiding the sanctions, and they will blame all the chaos that is rampant in the country on the fact that the EU are imposing sanctions upon Zimbabwe. So I think, all things considered, the bishops would want us, if we could, to raise some sort of voice in the corridors of power in Brussels and wherever, to get the EU to look again at the policy of sanctions. I think sanctions anywhere, applied anywhere, is always a pretty blunt instrument, and in the end it probably hurts the poor who it's intended to help more than it hurts those against whom it's specifically targeted. So that's one thing that we can do. The other thing that I think we can do is what we've been talking about already, is that I can do my best to make sure that the cry of the oppressed is heard.
And my thanks there to Bishop Crispian Hollis, Chairman of the International Affairs Department of the Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. Most Catholic bishops come to Rome at least once every 5 years for their ad limina visits to discuss challenges facing their churches with the Pope and top Vatican officials. Yet given the difficulties resulting from decades of Soviet oppression, bishops from Ukraine's Greek Catholic Church were unable to make such a visit for the past 70 years. But last week, Pope Benedict XVI welcomed the bishops on their first ad limina visit since 1937, rejoicing in their newfound freedom and the vibrancy of faith in their country.
Dopo che le vostre rispettive chiese hanno ritrovato la piena libertà, voi siete qui a rappresentare comunità rinate e vibranti nella fede che mai hanno smesso di sentirsi in piena comunione con il successore di Pietro.
The Greek Catholic Church is the second largest religious group in the Ukraine, counting over 3,300 communities, located largely in the western part of the country. In full communion with Rome, these communities follow the Byzantine rite and traditions, yet throughout their history have had difficult relations with their majority Orthodox neighbours. Under Stalin, at the end of the Second World War, the Greek Catholic Church was officially disbanded and forced to reunite with the Russian Orthodox Church. Despite harsh persecution, many underground believers kept their faith and traditions alive, and in 1989 the church was once again able to apply for official legalization.
L'odierno incontro, che avviene dopo oltre 70 anni, ci permette di elevare insieme a Dio un commosso ringraziamento.
After more than 70 years, Pope Benedict said this is a time to give thanks to God for the rebirth of the Church after such a dramatic period of persecution. But he also touched on the serious problems which persist in this new phase, such as the need for genuine vocations and the difficult dialogue with the country's Orthodox churches.
It's not a question of a dialogue as such. I think that for us, the main problem is to allow everyone to be himself.
Cardinal Lubomir Huzar is Archbishop of the capital, Kiev, and head of the Greek Catholic Church in Ukraine. At the start of these ad limina visits, he told me it was a very emotional moment for him and his brother bishops.
Well, it is, you know. We simply do not know what it is. We are learning. It's a very interesting experience, I must say. It has different aspects. It has a strong religious aspect. We look upon it as a pilgrimage to the graves of the apostles that we make together with the Holy Father. It's the first, so to say, impression, and then the meetings, maybe on a somewhat different level, with the Holy Father and with different offices, Roman offices here. This is another aspect of our being here, of our experiencing this visit to Rome on this special occasion of Ad Limina.
One of the issues that the Pope will address is the question of vocations. After a great flourishing of vocations following the end of the Soviet era of repression of the church, those vocations have dropped off quite dramatically, haven't they? Why do you think this is, and what are you trying to do about it?
Well, you see, I think one has to be very careful, because after the fall of the Soviet Union, great many came to the seminaries and monasteries, but were they real vocations? I think there was maybe, in many cases, there were the reasons for coming were not very vocational. So we have learned in the meantime to exercise much more discernment of those so-called vocations, because there is not the least doubt that there are many who are really cold and who came sincerely. There are others who came maybe because they thought this is going to be an easy life as a priest or as a religious. So I think numbers in this sense are a bit misleading. Do we have enough vocations today? No, I wouldn't say so. We do not experience such a number that we would consider sufficient, even though maybe in comparison with different other countries or parts of the world, the numbers seem to be very impressive. But when we consider our reality, we would gladly have more. And as a matter of fact, our synod has declared this 2008 year a year of vocations. And of course, we take this in a very large sense, Christian vocation in general, which includes not only priestly vocations, religious vocations, but vocation in general. Everybody has some vocation from God that which he should take very seriously and fulfill very, I would say, religiously. But we certainly will put emphasis on religious and priestly vocations, encouraging people to see them, not in the light of human advantages, but as a real calling from God.
Another of the great challenges facing your church is the difficult relationship with the Orthodox Church or churches in the Ukraine. Has there been any progress in this difficult relationship?
Well, you see, I think this is a very relative interpretation of the situation, because it is true, we do not have a formal dialogue, theological dialogue. We have very little formal contact on the highest levels, but we do have very close collaboration in the field of education, in the field of social services. We do have a council of churches who are Catholics, Orthodox, Protestants, and even others, Muslims and Jews are represented, that works very well.
So a dialogue of life which works quite successfully.
Our ecumenism, I would say the successful ecumenism in Ukraine, is on the level, not on the highest level, but on the level of daily life. And we collaborate quite well. This does not deny difficulties that exist, certain misunderstandings. We should not say that everything is very, very smooth and no problems at all. No, it is not so. But there is a peaceful coexistence in general where we try to settle these problems in a peaceful way and hope that we would have this maybe even on this very formal level also a smoother relationship.
What would you see as the most necessary things before this relationship can really improve?
Well, it's not a question of a dialogue as such. I think that for us, the main problem is to allow everyone to be himself. Very, very fundamental respect of the choice of one's religious adherence given to every person. Much of the difficulty that we have experienced so far has been in somebody to trying to outsmart others, of sort of make himself the center of everything. We have to arrive, first of all, at a very deep respect for the freedom of every person to choose his religious direction, and also for everybody to be able to testify to his conviction, not simply external tolerance, a like of a pact of non-aggression, but a real, deeply felt respect. And only, I think, when we have come to this, I would say, spiritual attitude, then from that point on, we can begin to really look to a deep communion between different believers of different directions today, wishing to ultimately arrive at the ideal which Christ has presented to us as his commandment.
And my thanks there to Cardinal Lubomir Huzar, Archbishop of the Ukrainian capital Kiev and head of the Greek Catholic Church in Ukraine. The Anglican community here in Rome has been saying goodbye this week to the Archbishop of Canterbury's representative to the Vatican. Bishop John Flack, director of the Anglican Centre in Rome, is returning to the UK after spending the past 5 years working closely with the Pontifical Council for Christian Unity and other Vatican offices. During that time, he's helped to set up 4 meetings between Pope Benedict and the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, and more recently, during the Week of Prayer for Christian Unity, he organised a first-time visit for the Archbishop of York, Dr. John Sentamu. As he was preparing to return to his new job of parish priest and assistant bishop in Peterborough, I asked Bishop John what had been the most significant experiences for him over the past 5 years here in Rome.
Well, there are 2 things. There are the great events, and it's been a wonderful experience to be present at the funeral of Pope John Paul II and the inauguration of Pope Benedict. It's been a special privilege to get to know Pope Benedict in short but meaningful conversations over the last 3 years. But in addition to that, there is the day-to-day work of maintaining daily dialogue between the Anglican Communion and the Vatican, with its problems but also with its joys, and the formation, as I've said, of many friendships. So in many ways, the most significant thing to come out of the 5 years is that I have made friends in the Roman Catholic Church who will be my friends for the rest of my life, and that's a very significant thing as we journey towards the goal of unity together.
What has been the hardest challenge, perhaps, over these years?
Well, before I came, I thought I wouldn't be upset by the knowledge that I would not be able to receive Holy Communion in Roman Catholic churches. But I have found that painful, and that is a difficult challenge, that we still don't share the Eucharist in terms of receiving the body and blood of Christ together. And that's, to overcome that barrier is still something which I think is important, and which I'm sorry has not been resolved in my time.
Finally, in terms of your own personal development, if you like, what have these years in Rome really given you?
A much broader and deeper knowledge of the Roman Catholic Church, and the realisation for the first time that the Roman Catholic Church, although it is centralised, contains within it people of widely differing views and aspirations. It's a much broader based church than I thought it was. So I've learned a lot about the Roman Church, and I shall maintain my interest in deepening the links with it as I return to England.
And my thanks there to Bishop John Flack, outgoing director of the Anglican Centre here in Rome. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. Join us again at this same time tomorrow, or find us on the internet, www.vaticanradio.org/English. For now, stay tuned to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.